This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Shirley Strum. She's the author of Echoes of Our Origins, Baboons, Humans, and Nature. Hi, Shirley. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. And thank you for having me on.
Well, it's really great to have you. And I also am thrilled to be able to talk to you while you're in Kenya and I'm in the East Coast of America. I think the affordances of technology sometimes are wonderful. Other times, as we know, there are issues, but this is one of the benefits that we get from the internet. So I just want to say, you know, this, I really am impressed with the book, but it's also, I think in some ways, it's as you kind of note in your preface that it's challenging because this book is about almost a half a century of your work. And there's, I found myself thrilled with the information that I, and the ideas, but it's also, it was challenging because there's so many things that I thought were really interesting that I wanted to talk about, couldn't fit them into an interview. So I'm going to try to focus on some key points that give you a chance to talk about your work and this book, you know, in a way that I hope will elucidate some of the things that I thought were really most interesting. Maybe you should talk a little bit about your history, because without, you know, going into too much detail, because the book itself is really telling your story. But I think maybe that part, you start where you end up with, where you are beginning your work studying baboons in the 1970s as a physical anthropologist, a primatologist, I guess you might call you, I don't know. Maybe you could talk about what spurred you to start that work.
Okay. The first thing I'd like to say is that 50 years is a long time. That's more than 50 years now. And everything has changed. You know, the baboons have changed. I've changed. Nature has changed. Science has changed. So when I try to combine or to encapsulate 50 years in any discussion or even in the book, it's hard work. So I started out wanting to see whether at that time the baboon model was the preference for early humans. And it was because we didn't know much about primates back then. And three different scientists studied baboons in different places. And yet when they brought their ideas together, they found that regardless of species or location, that they seemed to say the same things about baboons. Now, one of the things I wanted to do was to see if this was correct, because back then people were doing natural history. And just to give you an example, they only identified the males, which is an offense today, but it certainly wasn't an offense back then, because that was the bias that was embedded in the science. So I wanted to see whether what baboons were really like, and whether if I could take some techniques that were already being used in captive studies of animal behavior, focal follows, and the idea that every individual would be named, every individual would be attended to over a unbiased rota. I just wanted to see whether that made a difference. And it did. It made a huge difference. And I found that a few things, well, let me just back up and say, one of the reasons, and back then, baboon troop movements were on the cover of every biology book. I can't believe now I'm trying to find those covers and I can't find them, but they were there because it was the only case at that time of evolution determining anatomy and aggression. And the male baboons were thought to be the focus of the group to have a dominance hierarchy, to have females not to have a dominance hierarchy, and their status would rise and fall depending on the rank of the male that they consorted with, that they were sexually receptive with. And they performed all of the duties of protecting, policing, reducing social conflict, and all of that. And even when I started, I think the reason I got the money was that I was going to remove all the males at the end to see what happened to the social organization. And by the time I got to the end, I didn't need to remove them because I had a totally different view of what baboons were. And it's that view that focused the group on females. Females had families, and they performed the policing, the protection, and the reducing social conflict for their own kin. And then females also had a very stable dominance hierarchy. So that, and I would say that the hierarchy that I found in 1972 is basically the same hierarchy in 1980 and 1990. Of course, some females and some of their offspring disappear, but the rank order is basically the same. For the males, it was the opposite. Rather than having a stable dominance hierarchy, and I only learned much later that in order to get that hierarchy, the scientists in these different locations ended up feeding males in order to bring them in competition with each other so that they could decide who was dominant to whom. And so I kind of reversed the whole thing. Females were the core. Females had dominance hierarchies. Females were stable. Females performed all of those different functions for their own families. But males, and this is what fascinated me, aggression is always risky. And so males had what I called social strategies of competition and defense. And I can give you some examples of that. But even though males are built like fighting machines, there was a kind of projection into their behavior based on that. In fact, they're very dynamic. The dominance hierarchy doesn't last very long. There's always someone at the top and always someone at the bottom, but they're all juggling. They're juggling over a short period of time. So just because male Dr. Bob was at the top of the dominance hierarchy, he only stayed there for a couple of months, and then he started to decline as he managed to create relationships with females and infants that he could use in these social strategies of competition and defense.
So, you know, one of the things that this sort of touches on what I thought maybe was one of the big takeaways for me. I mean, there were several. One was that you were in the 70s working in a framework that had been established by male scientists. And I thought that from what your work uncovered was, or illustrated, was how the inbuilt biases of a male view change the way you study, the way not only the result of the study, but the impulse of behind the studying. So that, and it sort of reminded me of, you know, what I would consider in anthropology, it's the ethnocentrism. This was anthropomorphocentrism,
yes.
But it was also male centrism. And in other words, that your outlook dictates what you, how you study, and therefore what you see. And it kind of undermines the idea of scientific that there is no bias in, you know, in science, that it's meant to be just factual. But how can that be true if your bias creates the groundwork for the facts themselves? And it becomes a really interesting issue when you're thinking about studying non-human, but it also applies to studying humans or interacting with other humans, because you bring your biases with you. And I think, you know, the comparison would be, and probably true in Africa. I know less about African colonialism than I do about American colonialism. But if, when you read the early arriving white people coming from Europe talking about indigenous people or the landscape itself, they brought all of their biases with them and could not see clearly what they were faced with. And they created a vision or an environment for themselves that it was completely inaccurate. And it seems that that was what you faced when you tried to, when you initiated your work.
So I marched at Berkeley for Ms. I'm very upset that my daughter, who's married, is taking on her husband's name because he wants to possess her, which was the reason. But in any case, I didn't start out with a feminist agenda, but I do think in some ways that what I discovered was very appealing to second wave feminists at the time. I'm a little troubled by the male-female difference, the gender difference, because I know in the 1950s that the Japanese primatologists were studying Japanese macaques, and they were asking questions about kinship and relationships and all these things that we now decide is a feminine thing, but they were all male. So the reason I can't fall into that very compelling comparison between going in to have a female point of view or going in to have a male point of view is that when I started in the 70s, it wasn't as clear as it is now. And so for me, it was really about, well, let's see if these ideas hold up to not, I wanted to do a quantitative study where even the shy females or the even shy males would have equal amount of time. But as I've gone over the years, the science and the society has really changed with a great, much greater awareness of gender differences and also an awareness of the fact that you cannot separate science from society. And so one of the good things about the deconstruction part of anthropology is that they forced us, all of us, to look at, to deconstruct how we're talking about things. And the only problem was that the postmodern movement never reconstructed anything. So I think the good part was that they did force some of us to look at what we were doing in a way that no scientist had before. But the bad part of postmodernism was that they never put anything in its place.
Although I'm just thinking about, you know, I don't want to argue that point. That point is maybe too in the weeds for some of the people who might be listening. But I do think it's interesting. I recently interviewed a historian who was working with the Arikara people in Nebraska and trying to write an accurate, as much as possible, history of the tribe. And one of the things he talks about early on is listening to the oral history as a way of validating historical events. Because in most anthropological work, at least that I was familiar with when I was younger, mythology was treated as not literal, but as magical thinking.
Yes.
Myth is not real. It's not storytelling about actual events. It's all kind of culturally instructive and passing on stories so that people know how to behave. But in fact, in some ways, if you pay attention to mythology, it has many echoes, interestingly, as your title, echoes of what we say, and kind of historians say, real history. And I think what his point does try to rebuild a kind of a postmodernist view. In other words, actually pay attention to what people are saying, but from your perspective, treat it from their perspective. And in a lot of ways, that's what you do with the baboons. And we should maybe go back one step. One thing I thought was really important to realize, which I had not, is the way baboons, because they don't have language, they do communicate with one another in a really, and what you, I think this is one of the key takeaways for me from the book, is the complexity of baboon society and family. They are kind of formed into groups, which we might liken to tribes. And so maybe you should talk a little bit about how they communicate, because it's so interesting and so rich, but you would only know that from being with them as long as you have.
That's right. The first thing that I noticed was the amount of negotiation. And what I mean by negotiation is that they are seem to be discussing relationships and even direction to go in the morning through a set of nonverbal cues. And so the fact that they could talk to each other in this non-linguistic way really impressed me. And I needed to figure out what was the negotiation all about. And it was about first creating relationships outside of the family. So males would enter the group, because males leave their natal group, the group in which they were born, and move on at maybe 5 years or 12 or 7 years or even 10 years, and then move again. So first they had to win trust, these males. And I've spent so much time looking at males because they didn't make sense to me. Later, I started looking at females and thought something else about them. But a male has to win the trust of a female or of an infant. And that's hard to do when you don't have language. And I like to say that it's only humans who can lie, cheat, and exploit other people, because baboons can't. They have an unwritten golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And they operate by that. And I think, you know, I stopped thinking about human evolution early on, and now I'm coming back to it. But I think that we can look for the origins of some of the things in related animals and maybe even baboons. Although I like to say that they made me work very, very hard, because unlike chimps, where the communication just cuts across species, baboons, you really have to spend time to understand what they're doing. So first they negotiate about relationships. Then they negotiate each day about where to go. And it's really about how many individuals you can influence to go in your direction. But it's also about which individuals you trust. So if I'm a baboon and there's a male and there's a female pointing in directions, that female, I trust that female because she's old and she has lots of knowledge about where the food is. I don't trust the male that much because he's new. And, you know, what does he know? Now, this is me putting words into their mouths. So they're negotiating all the time about leading the troop and following the troop movement. And they're also negotiating about other things, like youngsters play, but they have a particular play face, so that it's called a meta communication. It's your mouth is open and your lips are over your teeth. And if someone is starting to play too roughly with them, then they show their teeth and it turns into aggression. And that's when family or friends will come and beat up the other guy, or at least threaten him. So the communication part, it astounds me how much they can accomplish without having language.
But one thing you pointed out, and I think this is really important, you know, thinking about social interactions in a group like theirs, they spend a lot of time, an immense amount of time on the negotiations. It's almost like that's all they do, aside from eating and sleeping and, you know, playing and having reproductive sex. They basically spend all their time in social interaction. And what's so interesting to me about that is, and I'm not sure whether you would support this idea, but that even because these primates are not, it's not like there are antecedents, they're kind of cousins, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Biologically. But human behavior and animal behavior do have some comparatives. And the baboon society reminded me of human society in that way, that when groups of people are together, they spend an immense amount of time negotiating. And it can be, I was thinking about communes, because I spent a little time living on a commune in the 70s. And the amount of time that we spent in discussions, I wonder if there's, you know, I don't know whether anybody ever studied the kind of social interactions in a commune. I think people were, it was a period that didn't last very long. But it really resonated. And I was thinking also about tribal groups of indigenous people who similarly value that kind of social interaction and the ability to influence the group by reputation and behavior. It's not always what modern people think. The values are not always what we think are the best. It's really interesting.
I would agree with you about the continuity. But I would disagree with you about, I think language, symbols, culture, whatever, cooperation, which are unique human characteristics, of course you're going to find some origins in some other animal or maybe animals. But it really has changed the nature of social interactions. I can talk to you without you being present. The whole reputation thing is extremely important, but it can be manipulated because we have the neocortex and we have a bigger brain and all of that. So it bothers me, looking through baboon glasses at what humans do, it bothers me that I can see how different the nature of social interactions are in humans because of these special human characteristics. We've changed things. And I would say that from the baboon perspective, that is looking through baboon glasses, this notion of human exceptionalism, which basically I buy, that it's been a bias in science and all of this, but from the baboon's perspective, it is a change maker. And also, if you just look around you, just recently, all of human infrastructure has exceeded all of the life on the planet. So no baboon, no chimp, no dolphin, no anybody could do what humans have just done. And that's why I think that those characteristics are the source of our good and bad behavior.
But, you know, I think that raises another couple of interesting points that you mentioned. One is cooperativism, and maybe allowed that humans in their exceptionalism took advantage of different brain structure, maybe the, opposed thumbs. I mean, there are all these different things that we can look at as contributing toward the success, if you will, of the human species. Of course, it may be a short-lived success on our inability to control ourselves.
Yeah.
All the things that got us here are also our undoing.
Exactly. Yeah.
And of course, sad because we are undoing not just ourselves, but the entire planet and everything else that inhabits it. That aside, the great crisis of our time, but that aside, the exceptionalism that you kind of are talking about, in a way, what you suggested is also could have been an accident in this sort of, there's no certainty in the way that evolution works. And I think you illustrated that at one point where you're talking about the possibility that baboons were making a evolutionary mistake mm-hmm. in their behavior. That really stuck with me. And of course, you have to read the whole book to get to this. So I think people should, that this idea that we kind of have the idea that everything was predetermined and, we got here because humans were smarter and better. We have language.
And we're
the
goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're not. We're just another. But it also could have been a series of mistakes and of not only of behavior, but also the accidents of good fortune in terms of how the world at large evolved. The natural world evolved in ways that allowed humans to become successful, maybe overly successful, but that's another issue.
I think that watching the baboons do things made me change my ideas about evolution and be able to include chance and necessity and all these other things. And I think evolution, given what the baboons are doing, is a lot more tolerant and lenient than the scientists are treating it. Because, for example, the baboons were going into the home range of another group, which baboons don't usually do, and they stayed there. The other group mobbed them. And usually mobbing is you just have to do it once and that's it. What you're saying is that you should not be here, or what you're doing is wrong, or we don't accept it, whatever that is. But they stayed for over 6 years, and the process changed along the way. But I don't think that baboons can plan 6 years in advance. I don't think humans are able to do that either. But what that means is that it's not, there were infants that died and females who died and a couple males who died. And the mortality rate of the youngsters was so high that the groups started to shrink. And so it means that it's not as constrained as, I think, not as constrained as we've been considering it. And I don't know how that sits with you, but for me, it leaves more room for accident and the future is part of the past. It's predetermined by what the past is. And I would agree with you because I had several troops that went, one went a long way away and another one went where I released them after translocation. And they had different experiences. And as a result, they behaved differently. And so it seemed to me that evolution isn't the way we think it is.
Right. Now, just going to one other thing that you're interested in that is part of the book, and I think is really important, is conservation.
Yes.
And how do we, what would be a kind of ethical view of animal conservation from our perspective at this time when we have expanded, thinking what you just mentioned, we've expanded our range as humans to a huge extent. And you show that in the last 50 years in Africa, but of course it's true in America
everywhere,
too,
yes.
Where humans have entered what was formerly wild space mm-hmm. and come into conflict with wild animals, changing the nature of conservation and also changing our thinking about it. And the way that one of the stories you talked about was when you went to Cape Town mm-hmm. and met essentially an environment where baboons are in the city. And it reminded me a lot of bears in America.
Yeah.
And coyotes here, where people really are challenged about their own thinking about what is human and what is wild and how do we interact. But how, and without, you know, we don't have time to go into all the details, but I'm really interested if you could sort of sum up your current thinking about wildlife conservation in the current world and the way things are going now.
So first, I want to say that all of the conflict is a people problem, and it's the animals who always pay the price. So I think, I don't know if this is going to work in Cape Town, but in my experience in Kenya, I think that coexistence takes what was a win-lose situation and makes it into a win-win situation, because both sides are compromising. They're not getting exactly what they want. But we as humans have not compromised all these years. And so, you know, I work with marginal people, and for them, the difference between saving a tree or saving a cow or saving a sheep really is the difference between putting food on the table for their family. And I would challenge anyone who disagrees with me to think about putting them in their place. So I think you can't ask marginalized people to do conservation unless you give them options. And it just seems to me like wealthy people and wealthy nations have to step up and provide the options so that people who live with wildlife can choose conservation over just survival. And, you know, we haven't compromised. We haven't asked of nature all these years. We've just expanded and expanded. We've gone into areas that were wild. Now the suburbs are in the wild. And it has a huge impact, not just on the animals, but on, again, I'm talking Kenya, on the people who live with the animals. So for me, it's about coexistence, but you have to provide options for people. And I think it's really fascinating because I teach in California. I go back for a term every year. And the people who were so active about conserving deer are now enemies of deer because they've overshot, you know, they've just grown so large in their population that those people don't want the deer anymore because the deer are bothering them. The hypocrisy of it is that the Humane Society of the U.S. is dictating the conservation policies in Kenya, and they wouldn't allow anyone from Kenya to come and tell them what to do.
Right.
Money speaks, and that's why I'm not a conservationist, but I've done conservation and community-based conservation. I'm married to someone who founded the community-based conservation movement. And if people are part of the problem, then they have to be part of the solution. And devolving down is a really important way to do it. But I would say we have to change our relationship with baboons. We have to change our relationship with nature. We have to provide options so that people who are facing the challenge of choosing conservation or choosing food for their family can do something else. And I think if wealthy people and wealthy nations can provide those options, then marginalized people will be able to conserve. Now, I'm not a conservationist, and I don't know the U.S. situation that well because I've been gone for 50 years, bouncing back and forth. But I think that that applies to the U.S. as well. In other words, coexistence, well, you know the history of the U.S. much better than I do, but the colonists took land, they took resources, they pushed away American Indians, they did horrible things to them. So we need to change how we look at nature, and we need to change what options poor people have. There's more biodiversity in cities than there is outside of cities. it just happens to be biodiversity that we're not that excited about. But there are a lot of poor people, too, in the U.S. And so those people need to have options in order to be able to conserve.
I agree with you. I think we have to end it there, but I really appreciate your taking the time to talk. And I want to recommend this book to anyone who's listening, because it is so interesting to think about, both another species, our history, our interactions with nature. And I think your book kind of has so many touch points that are challenging and interesting to us. We barely scratched the surface of the book. So I hope that people will have some time to read it. But thank you for coming on and talking about this book.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Shirley C. Strum about echoes of our origins, baboons, humans, and nature. Thank you.